Good morning, everyone. I hope everyone can hear me. For those of you online, if somebody could just chat in, Roger, or somebody, could you just let me know that you can hear me? Okay, perfect. Thank you. My name is Cindy Ives. I'm the director of the Center for Learning, Design, and Development, and together with the Research Center and Computing Services, the Office of the CIO, we are co-sponsoring this workshop and presentation today. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jutta Peverenis from the University of Toronto as our presenter. Jutta, I just want to tell you a bit about the people that we have around the table here and online. We have a number of our learning design, visual design staff and our technology production people from my department. And online, we have some people from the Faculty of Business as well. And online, we have a number of people, including academics, people from our CVU, that is the Canadian Virtual University partners, and a number of other academic staff and design and development staff available who are here to listen to you this morning, and then some of the rest of us will join you this afternoon. And we're just about ready to start here.
We're having a bit of a technical glitch in that.
No technical glitch.
Going to our tools. Just make sure we're sharing the application sharing, and click that off.
Okay.
Yeah. And oops, sorry. Didn't tools move again. Yep. Application sharing. Your entire desktop.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Good.
Are we good now?
I hope so.
Yeah. And now you just need to click on that to see it full screen again.
Okay. And okay.
Great. Okay. All right.
We're good.
Right. Welcome everybody, and go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here. This is quite exciting in that I've had many discussions with many people at Athabasca, but I've never been here. So it's quite a pleasure to travel here and to discuss this with you, because I've always thought that much of the research that we've been doing in personalized learning and inclusive design is the most applicable in this type of a learning environment. So what I want to present about, or just to give you a background of who am I and what do I do in this area, I'm the director of both the Adaptive Technology Resource Center and something called the Inclusive Design Institute, which is a regional partnership between 8 institutions in Ontario. The ATRC is a center that I started back in 93, and the primary purpose of it is the inclusive design of emerging information and communication technologies with an emphasis on learning and education. So making sure that the standard stuff that everybody uses is accommodating or is designed to be inclusive of people with disabilities, people speaking alternative languages, people with different cultural preferences. So the browsers, the operating systems, the learning management systems, etc., the emerging mobile systems are accessible. And what I want to talk about today is how do we optimize the learning experience for all learners? So how do we create an inclusive learning experience? And a large part of what I want to go through is sort of a retrospective look at what have we learned over the last 20 or so years since we've been looking at e-learning and since we've been looking at specifically learning object repositories, open education resources, the bold experiments that we did here in Canada together with the Connecting Canadians initiative and various other things which many of you have probably taken part in. So I want to ask, what have we e-learned and what have we possibly relearned in another context? If you recall, approximately 5 years ago, there were a number of studies that came out that showed the research comparing e-learning with traditional learning environments, and we came up with this conclusion that the no significant difference conclusion, and you're all probably very familiar with this. We concluded that it didn't save any money, it didn't save instructor time, and it didn't shift the bell curve higher. And there were many studies that replicated this both in the US and in Canada and also in Europe, which was a somewhat disconcerting conclusion. The interesting pieces of the bell curve were that, however, were that it compressed the bell curve. So what happened was there were more individuals, when you used e-learning, there were more individuals that fit in the middle of the bell curve, and so the bell curve in fact heightened. It assisted students who had difficulty with traditional delivery, so the bottom of the bell curve, and it made academic life easier for these students. Of course, that raises concerns what happened to the other half of the bell curve. We had fewer high achievers as well, and so there was quite a bit of theory about that, one of them, the dominant one being Thomas Marino, who postulated that it was we had created educational bulimics who binge and purge on facts, and therefore when we didn't require stress or tension to perform, and when there wasn't a competitive environment, they were less likely to perform well. But there were other theories as well.
There's a question in here. What definition of e-learning are you?
Oh gosh, okay. So I'm using a very general and liberal definition of e-learning. I'm using the e-learning definition that was used. I mean, I'm actually going to be doing bad things in that I'm going to be switching between various definitions of e-learning. But the one that I used here in this review of this literature was the definition of e-learning that was used in those comparative studies, where it was basically computer-mediated learning, and it in fact also in many of the studies included hybrid forms of e-learning. But anywhere where there was a distance component and a computer mediation component, not necessarily at a distance, was what certainly the U.S. research used. Some of the determinants of success, and I'm mashing together, I'm doing a mashup here of many, many different studies, because I want to very quickly go through just the dominant conclusions and get to some, well, what do we do with this? And I can, I will share the bibliography which links to each of these, but this is a synthesis of quite a number of research projects. But some of the things we've relearned, and the reason I say relearned is this is stuff we knew when we were looking at instructional design, and it's part of educational research from quite a ways back, is that, of course, action and interaction played a large part in learning outcomes. The usual conclusions of passive versus active learning, the usual conclusions about what do we retain if we are using active versus passive learning, the usual conclusions about engagement, that the more engaged the learner and the more opportunities we have for engagement, the better the learning outcomes. Ownership, personal relevance, and convenience and trustworthiness of the tool was the one additional thing that probably doesn't have a history in educational research in the past, but the trustworthiness and the ease of use of the tool and the convenience of the tool made a huge impact in learning outcomes as well. We learned again that the right motivators were important, so if you require external motivation and you were provided that, then you had better learning outcomes. If you required internal and you were provided that, etc. So it wasn't that there is a right motivator for all learners, but that if we match the motivators to a particular learner, that they were more likely to have good learning outcomes. So what did we learn? So taking all of that body of research, what were the conclusions that are significant to this particular topic? And I call these the beyond no significant difference conclusions. Some of the things that we learned is that in e-learning, in computer-mediated learning, and I'll try to be clear about what I mean by e-learning when I say it, we have the opportunity to emulate one-on-one teaching to address educational breakdown. And if we do it well, it allows scaling of the small class experience to large classes. Problem-based learning or discovery learning, interaction and feedback, student-to-student, student-instructor all helps in achieving better learning outcomes in a computer-mediated environment than in a traditional class. And one of the things that was interesting, if you tease out the research beyond the huge, no significant difference headlines, is that the best learning outcomes occurred when you have individualized instruction, personalized learning, and you have the greatest transferable deep knowledge when there's personal engagement. These are not new things. They're instinctual things that we've all known as educators for quite a while, but it was interesting to very compellingly relearn that in this exercise. We also learned that a great deal of learning does not come from teacher instruction in both the class and in an e-learning environment. It comes from peers, experiences, and self-directed learning. And personalized learning is not comfortable learning, but optimized learning. So the optimal challenge, meeting the student exactly where they are, but meeting the student just far enough ahead of where they are so that they have an optimal challenge. E-learning can address education breakdown, mismatch of pace, mismatch of knowledge assumptions, mismatch of learning style and teaching style, in that we can provide a flexible pace, we can adjust the time for reflection, we provide opportunities to address gaps, we can have flexible sequencing, choice of modalities, and redundant presentation of information so that it can be auditorially, visually, text-based presentation. And that bottom end of the bell curve, it greatly helped many marginalized students. So the student who is shy, the student who is learning English, the student who is disorganized, and the student with a disability. Of course, in each of these cases, it was the design of e-learning or computer-mediated learning that actually addressed these particular things. So when we had flexible balance between social and private learning, when we had a dual language opportunity, when we had structure various structure views to support the disorganized students, when we had flexible presentation and control for the student with a disability. So then there's another body of research. So that was specifically looking at e-learning. The other thing, of course, that we've gone through as an exercise here in Canada and that we've led, and don't try to, that image is not anything. It's just basically, I stole it from Norm. It sort of shows some of the many learning object repository projects that we've, that have lived and died here in Canada over the last, and in other places over the last decade or so. But we have gone through a whole set of learning object repository experiments. And back when Canary was funding e-learning, we had quite a few in Canada and quite significant, we made quite significant progress for the world in this area. So what did we learn? And the reason I have this here is because we participated. We had, I think, three specific grants looking at learning object repositories during that period of time. Some of the things we learned was that we had, how many of you here were parts of those learning object debates, definitions of learning objects, what is a learning object, how large should it be, etc. All of those, yes, some of you have. So you have the scars and some online as well. I can't enumerate the number of debates about how granular a learning object should be, how it should be structured, what it should look like. We were very obsessed with the size of it, but we learned that size doesn't matter. We thought that the key to broader reuse was size, and we knew that contextualization played a role. But I think in the end, and some of you may disagree with this, but because of course there were many sides to many of these debates, it's not how granular it is, but how flexible and transformable it is. We also thought a lot about how to make the connections as instructors or as educators, and what we ended up learning was that as in LEGO, which was one of the, of course, failed comparisons we used, in they go as and in active learning, it's the learner that makes the connection. There's learning and the act of connecting, and we can structure the process so that the learner provides the glue, and activities can act as containers for content. We also learned that the media doesn't matter. Rich media may be more entertaining, but it doesn't necessarily lead to better learning. Active learning in a vacuum of content can result in better learning than multimedia extravaganza that we feed the learner. And some of the exceptions to this, of course, are simulation for skill development. And so we also relearned the notion that there are different types of learning strategies and environments where different learning approaches and pedagogical approaches are appropriate. We learned that how we take things apart, it's how we take things apart, not how we put them together, that are somewhat important. For reuse, we have to provide flexible coupling of the activity and the content and the presentation, the content structure and the structure representation, the function and the control, and the content and the context. And I'll talk more about this. I'm sorry for going through it so quickly. It's not how we piece it, but how we close it or layer it, in fact. It's the objects are useful. It's useful to have learning resources or those content pieces, but they're not the most useful things. Resources for educators. Activities online are hard to create for the average educator, and quality activities, not the content, are the most applicable across topics and educational settings. If we look at what are the resources within learning object repositories that were most used, it was the content independent activities where you could take a particular, and I'll show you some of those a little bit later in my presentation, where you can take a template or a content independent activity and populate a debate with a simulation or populate an interactive exercise. Okay, so we learned all this stuff, and we have had, I think, probably 2 decades under our belt, and we've gone through relearning much of what we knew as educators already. And how have we responded as a country, as an institution, as a province, et cetera? Well, some of the things that we've done in the interim after learning all those lessons is we cut federal support for learning object repositories fairly significantly, and in fact for e-learning at a federal level, which is quite a blow, and the world was somewhat shocked at what we did there. If we look at how we've shifted the investment in education, the pattern seems to be that we've invested much more in math education, things that are going to address the needs of the normative student. We've decreased time and funding for preparation of curriculum, and that seems to be the case across all levels of education. I mean, there are some major exceptions which are quite wonderful, but if we look across Canada as a whole, both in primary, high school, university, college education, in most cases, the time that professors, teachers, et cetera, have to prepare their curriculum has decreased, and we've increased the class sizes as generally. Again, there are exceptions, but they're exceptions to the rule. One of the disturbing trends in our universities is we seem to have responded to this lack of funding, decrease in curriculum time, increase in class sizes, et cetera, in either taking the approach of survival of the fittest education, increasing our standards, but not accommodating individual differences, using the old trick of competition as a powerful learning tool. But the problem with this is that it doesn't necessarily produce the knowledge we need, and it leaves many casualties at the post-secondary level. At the other end, as I said, we've increased mass education, where the other approach is we're teaching to the lowest common denominator, and that's really optimal for no one, and it results in many disengaged learners. If we look at our instructional research dollars, many of them are looking at the quest for the statistical norm, the one-size-fits-the-most solution, as opposed to attempting to address the full range of learners. So it's not surprising to note that we have an increasing educational breakdown. Literacy, numeracy, retention rates are not in great shape. And in the last UNESCO studies that were done of Canada and Canada's performance in the world, there are quite a few disturbing things in there. We have difficulty serving even the average student, and to say nothing about the marginalized learners. I'm going to pause for a second because I'm talking very quickly. Any questions or disagreements? Or do people generally feel that that's a somewhat bleak but accurate look at the data?
If you could just reformulate that one more time, really briefly. So when you showed all those graphs, you were saying that, just speaking very generally, everything's set up now for the middle, so that it was, let's say, the C students. And then you went to the conclusion that this is one reason for the breakdown. Could you just flesh that out just a little bit?
Right.
It was a bit of a big jump for me.
Okay, good. Yeah, so what I'm saying is that because of our economic constraints, because of the decrease in funding, because of the lack of resources invested, or the decrease in resources invested in education, we've taken a few approaches. None of them, however, all of them are resulting to some extent in more students that are marginalized, more students that are dropping out. We're not increasing our literacy rates. We're not doing all of those things that we're supposed to. So the things that we're sort of, as educators, in a bit of a crunch, because we are acutely aware that education is a huge issue, that for the health of our society, we need to include the largest group of individuals. We need to be an inclusive society. And yet our educational approaches at the moment are not fitting into that, are not addressing that. Whatever we're doing, it's not working at the moment. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean. So given that context, as we know, we have many, many more marginalized learners. So that's not to say that we're not attempting to also address the needs of those marginalized learners. We're marginalizing learners, and now we have the problem of marginalized learners. And so we're addressing the problem of marginalized learners as a separate thing, right? We're not addressing it, certainly, in our generic approach, in the integrated delivery of education. Another thing to note with that is that that group of marginalized learners is increasing, right? Because our generic standard way of delivering education is dropping out more and more people. So what we've created is this notion of accessibility as a separate, segregated, special thing that we have to now address. And this separate, segregated, special thing that we have to address is increasing in intensity, increasing in numbers, increasing in the crisis of the problem. We now have this issue of accessibility and this growing issue of accessibility, we still don't have any system-wide strategy. In most cases, if you look across the country, we take band-aid approaches at greater and greater cost. The budgets, despite the fact that we have decreasing budgets overall, the budgets that are requested, certainly, and in many cases also assigned to special education, are increasing all the time, and yet the delivery of special education is not getting any, the indicators are not that anything is getting better in that area. Yes?
Can I just get you to, you're talking about education in general.
Right.
But are you talking about education at the elementary level, at the secondary level, at the post-secondary level, all of the above?
All of the above. So it's in post-secondary and community college and in K-12, the special education funding or special services funding or the assigned funding is, and the self-identified or the identified enrollment in those areas is increasing, which of course then requires some increase. It's not obviously that the performance is decreasing. So the satisfaction, the actual provision of access, the actual accommodation of the student is not improving. Okay. And some of this is, and I, in the bibliography you'll see that this is needs, the ADAPTECH needs several studies that sort of look at various different areas in the post-secondary area match what has been seen in the at the provincial levels. It's not carried, the accessibility approaches are not integrated or carried forward into future iterations. Accessibility guidelines in many cases when we have curriculum producers are seen to constrain creativity and seem to constrain technical innovation. And if we do achieve accessibility, it's usually accessible for everyone but optimal for no one, even if we're trying an integrated approach. And so what we see is an increase in a resort to rights and obligations. Mm-hmm. The number of complaints, the number of suits are increasing. And we are also going through this exercise where we are dividing up but putting into classificatory groups individuals who we have marginalized. So the marginalized learners now, for example, in the province of Ontario, we had something called the Learning Technology Opportunity Fund, which was only for students with learning disabilities and not for anyone else. And so then it became a huge issue of defining exactly what we mean by that and do you fit or do you not fit. And singling out that particular group for special treatment. But of course, so those students had additional privileges, but classification is a double-edged sword, and it's a very blunt and imprecise instrument when it comes to the complexities of the human mind, and nobody really fits into those, and we can get philosophical here, but those classificatory categories are fairly destructive, and of course they exclude and confine these individuals, and it's frequently accompanied by segregation. So the number of special types of classes that we now have, and I can't speak for Alberta because I don't know very well, but certainly in Ontario we now have special regional centers for ADHD as opposed to dyslexia as opposed to behavioral, and so we keep creating these additional specialized classes. And we're undergoing, as we're in 82, we had this interesting move towards integration. We seem to be going further into segregation and classification. And there I'm talking about K-12 largely, but we see it as well in post-secondary in that there's now calls for specialized universities as well, and there's calls for segregated, certainly there is already segregated exam administration, and there's more and more of these calls for things. But we know some of the things we've known for many, many decades is that segregation causes systemic problems. It's not sustainable. The first thing that gets cut when there's a budget cut is the specialized stuff at the periphery. And as a society, as learners, as educators, we need exposure to diversity for health and well-being, for creativity. We had that really interesting book that came out by this called The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett, which showed that when you have segregation and inequality, the society as a whole becomes more depressed, has less healthy, more violent, etc. And that also comes from some research within school systems. Okay, I'm not going to be dire and awful for the whole thing, but just this is the last blow. Okay, one of the other things that we have is in the area of accessibility, so separate from, I mean, and I mean layered on top of education as well, is we have what has been termed by the United Nations and UNESCO and various other groups as this technology, this growing technology gap. And that's because there's a breakdown in what we call the assistive technology market. Assistive technology are those technologies, those very specialized technologies that people with disabilities need to use to bridge the gap between what the computer allows them to do and what they need and their particular needs in terms of access. So it includes things like screen readers, refreshable braille displays, on-screen keyboards, etc. And all of those, the difficulty with all of those is they need to interoperate with everything and all of the applications that you have on your computer. So as someone, if I'm someone who's blind and I'm using a screen reader, my screen reader has to interoperate with my word processor, with my Excel spreadsheet, with my browser, with my learning management system, etc. And that's a huge task because that means that the screen reader has to, if you think it's hard to share files between a Mac and a PC, imagine how hard it is to create an application that has to much more intimately communicate with all of the applications that are on the desktop. And many of those are proprietary and many of them keep secret how you're going to communicate and how you hook into them. And many of those applications are constantly changing and frequently updated. And so every time there's an update, that screen reader software has to be upgraded. And to make it even worse, each of these AT vendors or these AT developers, assistive technology developers, have an extremely small customer base. So if Microsoft and Apple can't solve the problem, how can a two-person company with a customer base of, say, 30 people solve that problem? So what we have in the assistive technology area is we have less and less quality access at greater and greater cost. Can anyone guess how much a refreshable 80 cell refreshable braille display would cost? Any guess? Yes. Yeah, that's the cheap. That's a good deal. They will go up to $20,000 each. And how reliable and are they, or how robust are they? They break down more than any of these computers that are here. So, which is a huge investment. And the drivers to keep that thing going have to be updated constantly, which means that there's constant problems with interoperability. So it's not surprising that we have this growing technology gap because what's happening with technology as a whole is, of course, it's not slowing down. And we're creating, as were a few years ago, we were able to, there were a few number of vendors. Now everything's a mashup and you don't know where the application is coming from and so you don't know who to talk to about how do I communicate or how do I make this work. And so we have an increase in human rights suits as a result. So what do I propose? And this is the proposal that I have. And what in education, I think what we need to do is we really need to rethink, certainly in a computer-mediated environment, certainly in an e-learning environment, and in our educational policy environment, we need to rethink this notion of disability. And rethink it as, and what I'm postulating is that we rethink it as disability is a mismatch between the needs of the learner and the educational environment and experience offered. So not think of it as a personal trait, but as a relative condition. If you think about it, someone who is blind and completely an audio lecture or is less disabled than, say, someone who doesn't understand the language, in every context, some learner is experiencing a disability. And so then what we would redefine accessibility as is the ability of the learning environment to adjust to the needs of all learner. It's the flexibility of the education environment, curriculum, and delivery. And we achieve the goal of accessibility is to optimize the learning environment for each individual learner. So what I'm proposing here is, yes, I'm proposing that we flip this whole thing around, that we take the margins and put them at the center for everyone, because in fact at some point we can all be marginalized. So what are the, I mean, this is very nice to say, what are the implications of this, and why would we be able to persuade policy people to do this? And how can we support this? How can we optimize learning for each individual learner? I mean, we have a hard enough task addressing the needs of the norm or the average learner. Well, some of the things that have changed over the last two decades and that we really haven't used well enough is that we are now dealing with digital resources. And one of the things that we haven't really harnessed well enough is the amazing plasticity of the digital, the ability to transform, configure, swap things in and out, the ability to copy without cost, the way that we're not really, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of storage, it doesn't take, so copying doesn't take very much time, et cetera, replicating doesn't take very much time. And we also have networks. We can share and pool resources, we can reduce redundancy, we can polish, refine rather than replicate. And we have really good mechanisms of attribution now. We seem to be less concerned about IP and things of that nature. So we've come a bit of a way in this digital odyssey, as the OLA calls it, in that we've got over some of the initial growing pains. But we still haven't harnessed this well enough. We aren't using the community of networked educators and learners to pool, but there is that potential that if we pool, if we share, the more likely it is that we will be able to match each learner's uniquely individual needs, and the more likely we can provide a rich and challenging learning experience with limited resources to deal with those budgetary problems, and the more we can engage in collaborative peer-supported learning. But there's a bunch of buts. This requires network classrooms, network teachers, sharing, pooling, reusable curriculum, mechanisms for sorting, filtering, finding, mechanisms for matching, and we all know this already. It requires connected classrooms and a decrease in the concerns about security misuse and the dangers of the internet. I just went to a really, really sad place where they were outfitting the whole it was a new school being built, and they were making sure that there would be no cell signals coming into the school or extraneous Wi-Fi signals, so that the security of the the students couldn't go out onto the internet while they were attending school, which seems to be somewhat of a strange thing to do in this time. We need network teachers. Training, digital literacy, time, budgets to network teachers, and we need to get rid of our worries about sharing. So and our obsession with quality standards, and if we start sharing, we're going to reduce the quality of what, and we're not going to meet our educational requirements, etc. This sense of loss of control, the obsession with loss of intellectual property. And we need institutions to give us the tools and the mechanisms for pooling. And unfortunately, certainly in the province of Ontario, one of the issues here is that they're worried about liability, about compromising local academic standards again. So what do we need to do, and how do we create inclusive digital curriculum? Curriculum that can be optimized for each learner. For those of you who are familiar with inclusive design, it's a small set of fairly ubiquitous principles. Basically, what does inclusive learning or inclusive digital curriculum or inclusive design simply means that we need flexibility. We need flexibility in how the content is presented, the modes of presentation and display. We need flexibility in terms of how things are controlled. We need flexibility in how we navigate through the structure and what the structure looks like and how it's presented. We need to label things so we can find them easily. And we need to provide equivalent alternatives for content that can't be transformed. And all of these are things that I'll show you are useful for everybody. So when we design our curriculum, when we produce the educational resources, we need to make sure that we have that flexible coupling. That doesn't mean that the information isn't contextualized. It doesn't mean that presentation isn't important. It doesn't mean that how it's controlled and the mode of interaction isn't important. It is important, but we need to build in to the structure greater flexibility. Whoops.
I guess you'll have to repeat the question after I ask it because those are all new here. But
okay.
You're talking about inclusive design. Can you, is that the same thing as universal design?
Okay.
And, or if it's not, where are you getting to it? Why would you use one instead of the other?
Okay. That's a very good question, and so I'll address that very quickly here in a second. So universal design, I mean, to answer your question in a generic way, inclusive design is a form of universal design. One of the things, though, that has happened with universal design is people have interpreted as one size fits all. So because of accessibility legislation and the way that it's applied, people seem to think that something that's universally designed needs to, in every instantiation of it, have fit everybody. So it's and there's also this notion that you can certify something as accessible or not accessible. So it's not looked at relatively, right? And especially when we are in a digital realm, we don't need to do that. There's no reason to do that. We can transform the digital easily. And so what we get with that interpretation of universal design is we get that situation where it may be accessible, but it's really optimal for no one. We're compromising on many people's requirements. The other thing to note is that universal design is, in that interpretation, harms people with disabilities the most. Because if you look at the grouping of people that are classified as having a disability versus the grouping of people that are not classified as having a disability, the grouping of people that have a disability are far more heterogeneous than the group of people that are classified as not having a disability. And the group of people that are classified as having a disability have far fewer degrees of freedom to conform to the grouping or how you happen to have defined disability and what the notion of what it means to be accessible. The reason for inclusive design is that what we're talking about is not that one-size-fits-all notion of universal design, but a one-size-fits-one mass personalization, individualization notion of inclusive design, or of universal design. Does that answer? Good. Okay. So that, however, requires a shift for educators. We did an interesting experiment to see, to watch educators when they created a PowerPoint. Sort of a talk aloud protocol to see what were the primary concerns. And the dominant concern is still the font, the color, the look, the visual presentation is the first thing that they seem to think about, not what am I trying to teach and what are the various ways that I'm going to teach this, what are the learning outcomes I want. So we need to get around that, we need to think about a flexibility of path. If you look at the popularity of like single sequencing and SCORM, I mean SCORM is increasing in popularity all around the world, and that has a very fixed training pedagogy where you learn this, you're tested to make sure you've learned it, then and only then can you go on to the next stage. It's a very sort of fixed path. We need flexibility of pace. That we've learned a little bit better, and so many of our educational delivery systems do allow individuals to take more time, but not necessarily. we need to think about modularity rather than completeness, and be willing and open to the notion that somebody else might complete what we've created or add to it or collaboratively, cumulatively create different iterations of it. And we need to harness learning peers. We need to be more open to cooperative authoring, cumulative authoring, learner-driven construction. And one of the things, myths that we have to get rid of is this myth which seems to be predominant everywhere, is that accessible curriculum is drab, dumbed down, costs more, makes more, takes more time. And that's really not the case. You can have something that looks exactly the same, that has the same interactivity, and it can be accessible versus not accessible, and as the inaccessible resource. It also, this new notion of inclusive design or of accessibility and disability also requires quite a shift as computer users, because we're talking about computer-mediated digital systems. Computer users and computer users as learners. It requires a demand for personalization. And one of the things that is quite interesting to note when we look at the user interface on computers is we're not, unlike other places, where we're quite concerned about making things fit us and rearranging things. We are not concerned about it in our as concerned on it on our desktop. We know that we're most productive when we're in a comfortable environment, we know where everything is, we're not distracted by extraneous things. The tools in the space do not demand attention but become habituated. The space is optimized to our needs and the space is accessible. If you think about environments like your kitchen or your workshop or your artist studio or whatever, we take a lot of time and care, and people are quite obsessive about exactly where things are going to be. How many of you would freak out if, I don't know, your garlic press were put in the wrong drawer and things like that, and you really want to know where you're placing it. But what happens in the user interface or in our on our desktop or whatever we're using for that learning environment, and I would suggest that it's become contested real estate. We have developers creating these horrific interfaces where they view the user interface or the user experience as the lipstick, and that is unfortunately still the term that's used in many development shops. We have commercial interests. Many of us are losing lots of desktop real estate to Google Ads and other ads at the bottom of web applications certainly are a huge problem there. We have these mass market generic environments that are created by formal UX designers. We have the, we're imposed upon us are these conceptions of the typical user, the typical Gen Xer, the typical housewife, the typical CIO, and what if we aren't typical? We have institutions making their mark, and I'm not putting the most embarrassing one I've found. I found one where the learning management system had right across the top the university, then the faculty, and then the department, leaving about one-third of the real estate of the desktop for the actual learning application, which at the time was a really, really complex thing, which would have required the greatest amount of desktop real estate. Why do we need to be reminded which university, faculty and department we belong to when we're in the middle of learning? And we delegate all sorts of this security concerns to others. We allow the system administrators, the tech departments within our institutions to erect fences, gates, and interruptions to our workflow and freedom of movement. There's a horrible case study where in order to choose a particular course, and sign up for a course, that a student had to enter a password and go through six gates in order to just simply add a course to their curriculum. We don't retain the choice of what we want secured from whom and when, and why don't we do that? So in order to take this personalized approach, in order to look, relook at this notion of inclusive design, we need to, I think, as a whole, demand greater personalization. So what are the other things, or what are some of the things that we're doing, however, to achieve this personalization? One of the things that we are working on is systems to support this matching. So this notion of matching the needs of the learner with the appropriate resource, with the appropriate user interface. And one of the initiatives at the moment is a number of international interoperability standards, one of them called IMS Access for All, which then was adopted by ISO as ISO 24751. And what this does is it creates a common language for describing the needs and preferences of the learner on one side, and a common language for describing the learning resource. And I know that Norm Friesen was here about 2 weeks ago talking about the MLR and the metadata descriptions. And so the second part of this, the common language for describing a learning resource, is being integrated into that MLR. And once we have those two things, then we can we have some way of matching it up. What we need to happen, though, is we need to have these adopted universally. So the side that describes the learner needs and preferences has is done in such a way that there is no it's also referred to as the private portable preference profile, because the notion is that there's a lot of privacy built into this, but it's not attached to an identification, and there's no need ever to declare that I'm blind or I am deaf or I am anything. It's very functional statements about, and the intent is also that everybody uses this, not just individuals with disabilities. They're very functional statements about how do I want things to be displayed, how do I want or need things to be controlled, and what content alternatives, equivalents, or helpful tools do I want and need, and in what context. So you can create a personal preference profile that applies when it's the morning and you're at your desk and you have a large screen, or at night when you're tired and you have a small screen, or when you're traveling on the GO train or whatever, or commuting somehow. So different contexts can, you can produce different personal preference profiles for different contexts. In terms of describing the resource, the way that this works is that the attempt has been made to make sure that the individuals that are creating the default resource, meaning the majority of content producers, need only to put a very, very small label on their particular resource. So it simply requires one additional field. The primary resource has a statement about whether it can be transformed, whether it's amenable to transformation. And then, does it require hearing, sight, ignore that spelling error, or text literacy? And what are the locations of any known equivalents? So those are the statements that go onto a primary resource. And then it's possible to attach that to that primary resource, or link to that primary resource, through references, alternative equivalents. And there's a statement about what primary resources is for, and what learner preferences or requirements does this address. And one of the things that becoming more and more ubiquitously used in, certainly in the US, in Europe, in various projects, and one of the things that we're attempting to address is where do we keep it and how do we assert it? At the moment, the types of ways in which someone can take a personal preference profile from place to place include on smart cards. It was implemented through the CAP program, the Community Access Point program. Smart cards, including things like library cards, Bell calling cards, any card that has a bit of space on it, because it only requires about 8K. It can also be carried around on USB sticks. It can be stored on servers. The notion here is that somebody with this personal preference profile can walk up to, say, any multi-user terminal in a university or any library, and immediately that will reconfigure, or they can log into a learning management system and immediately that will reconfigure, or they can log into a learning object repository and immediately that will automatically reconfigure to their particular needs. So what are some implementations of this? And these are just a few. It should just simply let me go to the browser,
yeah,
right?
It should, good. Yeah.
Okay.
That's
just
where we cross our fingers.
Okay, good. We'll cross our fingers. So one example of this is Tile.
It's working.
Good, good, good. Okay. It's slow. Okay, here. And this was one of those learning object repository experiments that was funded through Canary. How many people are familiar with Tile? Okay, so this is the Inclusive Learning Exchange. It's a learning object repository that supports personalization. And basically, what happens here is if you haven't yet created it, you can create a, so if you don't have a portable preference profile that you're carrying with you, you can create it here. And then use it on the repository itself. So say, you know what, I'm going to go back and just show you without, show you the default first, and then I'll change my preference. Is it always this slow?
Yeah, the wireless.
Oh gosh, okay, and I have a streaming video. Maybe I should not choose a streaming video.
Actually, yeah, no, I don't think that'll come through good in a minute.
Okay, yeah. I'll do a quick one of it.
Okay.
Because I want to show you the, okay, maybe I'll do a video description. Oh, okay, and so say, okay, this is the standard, this is an undergraduate course in globalization and international migration. But say I am someone who is deaf or hard of hearing, I'm not going to be able to hear that. And actually probably you can't hear that and understand it because I'm talking over you. So then I'm going to go and edit my preferences. Okay. And I'm going to say I would like an alternative to auditory content. And I'm going to, gosh, it's slow. Okay. I'm going to say that I want English, I want to enable captions. I want them to be verbatim. I'm going to keep them as English. And I'm just going to save this and not go through the other stuff. And now the system uses that preference profile and looks for the appropriate thing to match it, and I have it with captioning. Okay, so say that isn't in fact my problem, and say I have, I don't know, here. Oh, okay, anyway, so, no wait, yeah, right. Oh, no wait, I'll go to the introduction maybe. I'm going to show a page where I'm going to get it just a text page because I'm hoping. Okay. So say, in fact, I have a visual impairment and this text is just not readable. It's not high contrast enough. So I can go and edit my preferences. And say, I'd like to make the text easier to see. It's funny what we get used to in terms of speed, right? And say I'm going to make it all cerise because I don't like the cerise for whatever reason. And I won't do it monospaced or anything like that. And I'm going to increase it to say 18 points. And I think I'm going to swap the background and foreground. So I'm going to make the foreground white and the background black, and my highlight color I'm going to change, say, to green. And now I'm going to save that. And so the thing to note is, okay, and there we go. So now I have a high contrast version of that. Now, this particular globalization international migration learning object was not authored in any other way other than that it was, we made sure that it was using CSS and as the styling so that it would allow the styling transformation.
Question?
Yeah.
Why would you reproduce the functions of assistive technology? Because if you were using assistive technology, it would do this for you. So why can the website introduce that?
Okay, I will tell you why. Because for quite a number of reasons. One, because the more the number of individuals with assistive technology is decreasing, in fact. And so as the number of individuals who have disabilities who have access to assistive technology is decreasing, this is used around the world. Assistive technology, even as a notion, is only available in North America and in some of Europe and possibly Japan and perhaps Australia and New Zealand. In most of the world, there is no such thing as an assistive technology developer, vendor, and people don't have access to it. Remember I talked about the crisis of IAT at the beginning? One of the things that you'll note is that assistive technology, the price of assistive technology is increasing all the time. As everything else in this ICT market is decreasing in price, assistive technology is increasing because the attempt to try to create a specialized system that will interact with the computer system is getting harder and harder all the time. And so the performance of those assistive technologies is getting worse and the price is increasing. And the amount of the world that has disabilities that has access to it is decreasing as well. So we can't rely on assistive technology. If I have Zoom text, I'm not going to change it in my preference profile. And the preference profile is set up so that if you have Zoom text, it can detect that you have it and it won't clobber each other. They will harmonize. But there's no way that I can assume that the learners that are using this are going to have the appropriate assistive technology for that.
So what you're saying then is that every institution needs to reproduce software assistive technology and make them
their site? No. Definitely not. That's not what I'm saying. And this is not the functionality of ZoomText here. ZoomText has to get so ZoomText is a screen magnification program, contrast program. There's a whole bunch of stuff here that I don't have to do because ZoomText has to, as an external system, interoperate with my application and with my content. It has no direct control over my content. It has no direct control over my UI. And so it has to do a ton more by virtue of being a separate application. I also don't have here things like the lens or the splitting of the screen or any of those sorts of things. But there's many things I don't have to have by virtue of I'm the default, and so you don't have to try to get around me to make it accessible. But no, I'm not replicating, and I'm certainly not replicating all of the functionality. But the more we do, and this type of thing, of course, benefits. So exactly the same stuff we've done here to allow contrast and magnification makes it possible to see this on an iPhone and to see it on a BlackBerry and to use it on large public displays. None of this here is only useful for someone with a disability. It makes it much more flexible and usable for everybody. And so to state it as replicating assistive technology, definitely not. I'm making it possible to achieve this without having the cost and the trouble of what we have to do to create an assistive technology for people who don't have access to assistive technology. But Some other things that no assistive technology does, actually, now that is that we can do by virtue of it being the primary default application or the standard application are things like I'd like to enhance the structure of the content. And yes, some of JAWS will do some of this, but it frequently doesn't work very well. Next. Okay, so I'm going to I'm going to get rid of the notes and toolbar. I can do things like support. I can change the layout of the screen. I can so now I got rid of that the one toolbar, but I can get rid of both. I can have a top-down restructuring of the entire site so that I can either go through it serially with the next link, or I can have it a whole summary of the entire thing. I can do things like provide a glossary or a a dictionary on the side, or a traveling dictionary or glossary. So some of the things that might happen in some of the learning disability supported software tools that do it directly in the learning management system and directly in the LOR. Exactly. That's right. And that means it's much more sustainable. It means it works better. It means it doesn't have to be updated every time you update the Mac. So that's exactly the principle that we're looking at. Is as much. So let's build our applications, our platforms. Let's not look at it as a special thing. Let's build it directly in. So this is direct accessibility, because from an economic perspective, from a perspective of everyone, this is building that type of flexibility into our standard systems is a much better and more sustainable approach than segregating it out to the periphery and requiring that special things have to happen, like special assistive technologies.
Garrett just mentioned efficient mics. Please repeat the comments and questions.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So the question was, do we need to replicate in all of our applications or in our learning tools the functions of assistive technologies? So some other examples of implementations, I'm not going to actually demonstrate this, but there's a series of web services called Transformable. So the idea here is we provide the web services that are needed to make this possible for standard learning object repositories. And the web services include Preferable, which is the preference wizard, Styleable, creates a style sheet that renders your page, as long as it's style sheet compatible, with the appropriate style sheet to meet those preferences. Sensible, which disaggregates and reaggregates and adds things like captions and descriptions. Authorable, which allows you to create content that is amenable to that transformation. And then another example implementation is the Fluid Project, which is a large open source community which is working on designing software that works for everyone. So the same sort of principle. What Fluid has is, especially for web applications and for interactive curriculum, are a number of resources, including a design handbook on how to do this, but a whole series of components, reusable components. So so here are some examples of components. And these are four things that typically are very hard to do, the pain points in creating web applications and interactive simulations and things like that. Things like progress bars. The UI options is a way, is a component that lets you integrate that preference wizard into your application. Things like rich text inline editing. One challenge that many, many applications have is reordering, copying and pasting, dragging and dropping, those sorts of things in an accessible way. And so these components are will work with any of the other component sets, including things like Dojo, jQuery, GWT, or whatever you're using to create your interactive apps. And they'll layer on top and allow you to do it accessibly. There is the Fluid Skinning System, which is a skinning system that makes content and applications and things of that nature amenable to transformation. So for example, let's look at one of these. So this is just showing you the, I'm going to go to the demo of the video. Oh, but videos are not good, right? I have a very nice little video that shows how
we can look at it.
Good idea. Yeah, yeah. Okay, and timing, in terms of time.
Can we out of time? Just keep talking.
Okay, good. Okay. So with Fluid, we've now also gone into the mobile space. So for mobile learning, we have a project called Fluid Engage, and it allows you to create both web applications that are cross-platform and native applications for iPhone, BlackBerry, and Android. And we're going to the Symian platform and soon to go to the Safari platform for African OERs. And that you can get at from the Fluid link, and we can look at that further this afternoon. Some of the types of things that we do with Sensible, when I talked about swapping things in and out, is take here, for example, that a typical, this is a template for a debate structure. So the topic of the debate is their life on other worlds. These are the participants. These are the URLs that are resource material. And we have a chat for the debate, and we can show slides. So reconstruction actually of skinning of a particular environment that you're probably all familiar with. That same debate template can be reused here for now Cooked Cod, the role of global warming and the decline of the East Coast fishery. So we've got exactly the same, so this is an example of a debate template where we have an activity that can that is accessibly designed and is quite flexible and can be reused with different content. Here we have swapping in and out of different learning objects when someone has expressed, so this is teaching metric prefixes. Here it is in a high contrast text only version. Here it is with more visualization and more image intensive, and here it is as a social networking application because someone has decided that or has declared that they would prefer to learn it in a group setting or in a constructivist approach. The multi-million-dollar question, I guess, from all of this learning that we've done is, can educators learn, and can education systems learn, and can we, in fact, learn from all of the various things that we've relearned? Okay, and I would love to unpack further sort of this issue of accessibility and assistive technologies and the role of assistive technologies, because I think that's a very good question, and it's an interesting way of framing it, because it's interesting to note the sort of how you see assistive technology, or I think ATIA, the Assistive Technology Industry Association, and assistive technology vendors probably have a similar response to this type of thing. But I think the conversations that we've had with them have been that by doing as much as we can in the default or the standard, then we can deal with the much more individual, much more specialized things much better. Because certainly, if you're an AT vendor, any AT vendor that we speak to, they're quite perturbed by the whole challenge at the moment, and many of them are thinking that it's getting harder and harder to do what they need to do, and are quite frustrated with the challenge of having to accommodate the frequent updates, the confusing mashups, and so would much prefer to have those types of standard things that are now integrated into Apple and operating systems, done by the operating system vendors or the application vendors, and so they can focus on the things that really make it easier for individuals with disabilities to get at things. Yeah, definitely.
Hold on just one second. It's Cindy here. I just want to say thank you, and I want to say that part of the multi-million dollar question for us is the fact that we've just received multi-millions of dollars, and we have a new mandate in the university for accessibility, and we have some work to do. So that's really the subject of our conversations this afternoon. I'd like to open the floor for questions to people online first. So if you could give up the mic, there may be some questions.
Yeah. How do I do it? I just...
Go. Hi, this is Ian Grabois. So my question is, in terms of practically implementing accessible design, looking at it as an institution and an institutional culture, accessibility can turn into a list of rules and debated details. How do you create an institutional culture that promotes quality and innovation that results in products such as the iPhone, which is both high quality and innovative in terms of accessibility?
Actually, I have a whole question. Thank you. I mean, if I could have paid for a question, that would be a good question to ask. So, one of the things that I've been asserting is that this non-relative view of accessibility is, in fact, what's causing all sorts of. I think it's doing harm. The notion that accessibility is this finite set of certifiable things that you need to do is really not helping us very much. So let's take, for example, an institution that has to create an accessible website. Or let's not harp on educational institutions because the government does the same. So the government has something called the Common Look and Feel, which is a set of criterion that government webmasters have to follow in order to have an accessible website. And back in December 2005, about 40% of the government website went away. And the reason was because that was the deadline when they had to meet these accessibility requirements. So they determined that about 40% of their content, they couldn't meet the accessibility requirements. That, of course, made the website that compromised the situation for quite a number of learners because they lost, or number of users, because they lost access to a bunch of content. The other thing that happened in the federal government is they had a set of check marks that were based upon WCAG 1.0, which was created in 98, and went prior to a lot of interactive content and prior to Web 2.0 applications. And so this is still the standard that most webmasters in the federal government have to follow. And yet, the other thing that happened is the federal government told those same webmasters that they had to create interactive content, and they had to put government services online. Most of the government online services and the interactive content uses JavaScript and interactive applications. And so, but WCAG 1.0 has a proviso that if you are using JavaScript, you have to be able to do it without using JavaScript, which then meant that the accessibility offices within the federal government said, well, nobody can use JavaScript, and yet these same poor webmasters were told they have to get government services online. So they're in an impossible catch-22. What then happened there is that if you look at most of the chatter between these webmasters, much of the discussion was not how are we going to achieve accessibility, but how are we going to achieve getting excused from being accessible because we have a mandate that requires interactivity. And so accessibility got a really bad rap. It was seen as this horrible thing that prevents creativity, stops technical innovation, and something that was, and the irony of that is, of course, in accessibility, we need as much innovation as we possibly can. We need to innovate, and the more flexible, innovative technologies are the most helpful for somebody who has a disability. And so this notion of a finite set of rules or a non-relative sense of accessibility, a non-individual sense of accessibility, is really counterproductive. And this is why we're wanting to move it more towards inclusive design, more towards personalization, one size fits one, mass customization, because that is a trend that's happening within digital world anyways and within learning, and it benefits everyone. So the more that we can encompass the margin in the middle, especially in our design, the better off we are, the more sustainable it is, the less likely we're going to have the accessible segregated solutions drop off when the budgets decrease, etc.
Yeah, my question is more as an institutional culture, how do you get away from those disconnects? Because on one hand, they want to be more accessible, which generally leads to rules, which generally can't keep pace with the current needs of users online.
Okay, so the rules that we replace those rules with.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, so the question is, as an institution, how do you change the institutional culture? Because most institutions want to deal with rules, and those rules then constrain. Is that a good?
Basically, the rules can't adapt fast enough.
Yeah, the rules can't adapt fast enough. So rather than those didactic, inflexible rules, as an institution, the proposal is that the rule be flexibility, flexible control, flexible presentation, personalization. So those rules that are associated with making sure that our systems can adapt, things that promote adaptability as opposed to things that constrain the technology that we're using and that constrain innovation. This is another reason why, the reason why we have rules, the reason why we need we have legislation, the reason why we have sort of court cases and those sorts of things is because we've pushed people to the extreme. We've marginalized them with our standard systems. And so what we need to do is we need to make our standard systems more inviting and more inclusive, and then the less rules we'll need to accommodate people who are at the margins. It's not necessarily something an institution can do on its own, because the institution is existing in another larger legislative context, and probably education system is in another context as well. So this is something that we need to reform right from the top down. One of the things that we're doing in Ontario is we have something called the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. And what we've tried to do in that is for the Information and Communication Standard, which covers curriculum, we've tried to state it in such a way that rather than saying, do this technically, use this technology, do not do this, we are in the legislation saying, make accessibility is relative to the individual. Make sure that you are accommodating the needs of the individual and do this by being flexible. And so if people require rules, if you have to have rules, then make them rules that are going to allow for greater room for innovation and greater room for individual differences.
Any other questions here? Okay,
we're already
supposed to do this, but he just left, so.
Okay, here we go.
So then if there aren't any other questions, I think I'll take this opportunity to thank you, Yuta, for your presentation. Rory's just walked in. I'm going to let him thank you as well.
I also would like to thank you. I'm sorry I missed most of it. I'm running into some deadline problems, as usual. I'd like to thank you very much, and I'd like to impress on everyone just how important it is for the university to meet these accessibility standards. They are being mandated now in the United States. They're not quite there yet in Canada. That's a good reason that we need to be ahead of the game. And the other good reason is for our students, we have a higher percentage of what would be called, less abled or whatever, students than most other universities because they can't study at home. And so it's even more imperative on us as a student-centered university to make sure that our materials are accessible. So thank you very much, Yuta. We greatly appreciate your time and efforts in coming here. Finish with him.
Yeah,
thank you, everyone, for participating. And we'll shut down now. Yeah.